So our topic today was how experience changes brain development and behavior. Brain and behavioral development is a prolonged process that can be influenced by events occurring both before and after birth. Early life events can have direct effects, including a range of neurological conditions, such as mental retardation, cerebral palsy, epilepsy, autism, or fetal alcohol syndrome disorder. Early life events also manifest indirectly in child development disorders, such as learning disabilities, hyperactivity, and developmental delay. So once again, I'd like to have Dr. Brian Colby with the Department of Neuroscience at the University of Lethbridge come up. Thank him again for his topic and address any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Before we start the questions, Dennis Fitzpatrick made a good point, and he said, you said it would be obvious what you're talking about tonight, and it isn't. For those three of you who might be interested to hear more, what I'll be talking about is beyond childhood. I'll be talking about how experience sculpts the adult brain, how experience is altering your brain as you're sitting here, the impact this has on aging, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and stroke, and that sort of thing. There'll be obviously conceptual overlap in that. I'm talking about plastic changes in the brain, but the emphasis will not be on change. Okay, Howard.
Howard Forsyth, I have to make a disclaimer. These people have treated me so well in the last several years that I'm way on their side, so I'm not going to ask any nasty questions. Secondly, all kinds of people have said, how come you act like 70 when you're 90? I now know all of those things they showed on lower early childhood. My mother was very mild. None of my brothers and sisters were violent or suicidal. All of the good things happened to me. That's why I still survive for everything. But that's my question. He's explained the early life. I'd like him to say more to us who have climbed up to retirement and the culture thinks we're going downhill. No, you know I say we're not going downhill if we're able-bodied. So all of us, what can you do to help us from here on? I know that I'm losing all my short-term memory neurons, and I can live with that, but what can you do to encourage us? And his secretary, Naomi, is a fabulous girl. She said, get everybody out tonight. It's a different talk tonight. So these are people who have got a lot to tell us. Maybe the most important research category in North America. What about our later lives?
Well, I'm going to make a comment that won't please the university, but they don't think that after age 65 we should be there. And so some of you know that my colleague Ian Wishaw is quite unhappy about the fact that he's not one of them. Anyway, that's just tongue-in-cheek, although it does affect me. The key thing here is that it's a use-it-or-lose-it situation, so that, in fact, your being here is what you need to, not that necessarily I'm the solution or the salvation, but it's the brain activity that's critical. We know from studies of elderly people, and you would qualify, I'm afraid, Howard, in that category, in spite of your youthful appearance, and elderly animals, that if they do not have social interaction, their brain starts to deteriorate. They do not have intellectual interaction, and in fact, the social interaction is a real key one, and of course what happens, this is an interesting dilemma, is that older people, when they're living alone, don't want to give up their independence and live in any kind of facility, but it's really easy to become isolated because they're at home and they're just sitting there. And so one of the key things here is brain activity. Diet is another key thing. I'll talk a little bit about that tonight. Diet can influence brain activity. Diet can influence the longevity of the brain as well. And so it's really a chemistry as well as intellectual and motor activity that's the key thing.
My name is Brian Christopher. Thank you, Brian, very much for the illuminating presentation today. Activities, my passion for photography was taken many times to isolated Greek islands and isolated villages in Greek islands. And one of the observations that I've made over the years is that women who become pregnant are supported just incredibly bullied by the entire village. They know that they got support from everybody in the village, and they're comforted and well looked after, and children are given special attention in those early years. I think that they probably learned that without the scientific background that you have, over eons of trial and error, and came to those conclusions. The question I want to ask you is, do you think that our present lifestyle and our present value system is taking us away from that and jeopardizing the welfare of children by putting such a stress on both parents and family?
Well, I mean, great question, and I do think so. And it's not just the Greeks. In the Andes, some of the native populations have a program that's become kangaroo care, is the word that's used. And as you know, kangaroos raise their infants in pouches, and so the idea is that you have the infants always in a pouch and always being carried around. There's always tactile stimulation. So, one of the problems of being a scientist is that half your job is to discover the obvious, and in a sense, that's what we're doing. But to get to the crux of the question, is our modern lifestyle leading us down a path that may not be in our best interest? I think it is. And part of the difficulty is in getting the politicians to recognize that this is the case and to start understanding that there are solutions. And given that the crucial years are the first few years, we need to invest more money in finding ways to ensure that a caregiver can stay at home, for example, for those first, say, 4 years, that sort of thing. We were talking about that actually at lunch. And I think that as soon as we recognize that this is the case, we're going down the right road. There's a meeting in Red Deer in May that I'm attending. There'll be 140 or so politicos from Canada and Australia attending this meeting, and it's on the topic that I raised today, but it's 2 days, and they're going to hear from a whole pile of us. I'll give a much expanded presentation. But there are, I think, were 6 or 8 of us speaking to this group, and the whole idea is to try, the deputy ministers, assistant deputy ministers, and so on, to try and convince them of the importance of these programs. Fraser Mustard, who started the McMaster Medical School, which has become a model for all medical schools now, it's the problem-based kind of program, is the person in Canada who's pushing this the most, and he's been able to actually make some inroads in Toronto with certain community centers that have been set up. And the question was, if you set up a community center and you have pediatricians going there regularly, will people come? And it turns out that in the first program that they had, 98% of the people in the community came with their kids regularly, several times a week. The pediatricians actually came there, so the mums, if they had concerns, could actually interact with the pediatricians. There's a program in Okotoks that was started by Margaret Clark, who's a pediatrician in Calgary. Same thing. They went out to Okotoks, and they were there, I think, 2 days a week, went to the schools as pediatricians. The mums could come to the schools with their preschoolers and actually interact with one another and the pediatricians. And I think that's the kind of program that we need to do, and to get back some of this old-time logic or knowledge that we've lost.
Don't trip me. Why, of course. I feel terrible for working late again.
I remember now why I'm always doing very classes. I have a question for you.
She was much older than me when she was in those classes.
Let me tell you, Richard. Tell me, how can it be that if you had all of this nurturing as a child and from the same two parents, that when you have three children, they can be all so totally different?
Well, since I know those three children, I'm going to be very careful. Three wonderful children who are also very different. Well, because when you shake the genes up, of course, from the two parents, you get a different combination every time. And the genomes, I'll give you an example, it has nothing to do with your genes. An example. So we have a gene for what's called the serotonin transporter. And what that means is serotonin, which is a brain chemical, is taken up by cells. So you make it, and you've got to take it back up again. And there's a little mechanism called the serotonin transporter. The gene, we all have a gene for this, but there are two forms of this gene. There's a, what's called a short form and a long form. If you were to express the short form, your personality and your ability to cope with stressors, is very different than if you have the long form. Now, it turns out that most of us in this room probably have the long form of the gene, but not all of us, and various experiences can cause a change. You might ask, why would that short form even exist? Well, it turns out that in situations that are quite dire, so if you're, imagine being raised in post-war Europe as an infant, things were not good. It turns out that having the short form of the allele is an advantage. That if things are really bad, it's good to be really tough. In the environment we're in now, that's not the case. So if you extrapolate that and you begin to say, okay, we have all of these genes, you may have one or the other, and they're going to interact with the experiences you have, the outcomes are going to be quite different. And it doesn't mean that any of them are bad or good, it's just they're different. And as you well know, your kids are all different, and so are everybody's kids. But here's something interesting. There have been studies on identical twins. So twins who come into the world with the same brain, essentially. Well, as I explained to you, the brain is being affected by all these experiences. As they develop, they don't have the same experiences. And by age 55, the brains and the cells in general and the bodies of identical twins are as different as siblings would be at birth. Are you with me? So if you take two babies who, or brother and sister, let's say, or making the same sex, two sisters at birth, their brains are different but fairly similar because they don't have many experiences. The identical twins are identical. At age 55, that's not true any longer. The brains of the kids who were not twins are really, really different by age 55. But the brains of the identical twins are now as different as the kids who were not twins were when they were born. So you can see that the experiences are changing our brain as we go through life, and that's one of the reasons why you start seeing more and more differences. One of the discouraging things for women, I think, is that as the hormones start to decline, the female brain and the male brain become more similar. I'll say no more on that.
I remember.
You remember? Good. I'm still very one of your admirers of your work. But my question has to relate to the Romanian orphanage. And I guess I want to create this greater awareness of Aboriginal people in Canada. And not too many people know about or like to discuss residential schools. But I'm wondering if you could somewhat affirm what I might be thinking, in that there's been so many generational effects from the first group of children that went to residential schools until today, and we have so many of those ACEs that you talked about, and they're prevalent in First Nations communities. If you see in urban areas where there's a high Aboriginal population, we almost always fit into those categories, and myself, both my parents attended residential schools. But can you somewhat affirm that and say that even though the Romanian orphanage, and that was a natural experiment, where the residential school is a natural experiment here in Canada and in the U.S., and is that maybe why we see so many of these different behaviors? And the gentleman who spoke about the respect and just the community involvement when women are pregnant in retirement, is that what you said? I know from when my grandparents and their grandparents shared stories, mothers were respected and revered and just treated like, I'm going to use the word queens, but just the ultimate, because they were bearing children. Now, if you see our street today, we see Aboriginal women that it's so painful to be an Aboriginal woman. and I teach sociology. And if you look at our social stratification system in Canada, I'm a minority and I'm a woman, and I'm doubly disadvantaged. So how, you know, all these things come into play, but I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
So you're right. One of the factors here, of course, is the age in which children are placed into whatever it is, whether it's an orphanage or a historically residential school or a Catholic boys' school, for example, where kids were taken from their homes, not just Aboriginals, but Ian Wishaw, taken from the home at age 6 and plumped in school. So it really speaks to the age that it happens, and the earlier it happens, the worse it's going to be after age 6 months or 2 years. The key thing here is how do we deal with it? And I think what we have to do is to start by recognizing the ACEs and now going into the communities and trying the Aboriginal and other communities and trying to change, not worrying about what caused it, saying, okay, you broke your leg, let's not worry about why you fell off the bike, let's see if we can fix the leg and actually focus our attention on that. And hopefully, with one of the programs that we're trying to get funded, that's one of our goals, is to work with the Blood Tribe, for example, see if we can't take some of what we know and translate it into making a difference. And some of you will know Esther Tailfeathers, who's a physician at Standoff and so on. She's on board. Chris Shade's on board. So I think that it's doable. We understand the cause. We just need not to focus on what caused it, but how we can solve it.
I'm very appreciative that she said that, because I'm actually from the Blood Tribe, and I actually know the more aware we are of all these issues, then the greater that our whole society becomes more intact and wanting to work together to find solutions and to decrease all the staggering statistics of our population, not just the Aboriginal people.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Brian.
She was not one of my students.
And I'm old. I guess I was one of the luckiest young professors at the U of L coming in 1978 and seeing Brian and Ian down at the end of the hall. I was in education and psychology, seeing these bright young sparks and how they changed the faculty of the whole university, in fact, by bringing in the graduate program that was thanks to them, and then the Center of Neurological Development, and really making the University of Lethbridge a star on this planet. So we're fortunate to have them here in our small city. And I am so excited, as a psychologist myself, to see someone who is going from the research into the political. I'm very, very interested in the fact that the politicians do want to hear this research, especially with the way that our politicians in Alberta would like to blame Canadian people, especially poor, and with 1 in 5 children being raised in poverty. I think research has tremendous implications for not only prenatal work with mothers and honoring the mothers and feeding them like gold, but also our young women and young men are starting to be adolescents, training young people how to be parents. We don't even really have good sex education programs in the school, we don't have parenting programs. But there are some factors in society that are trying to change these things, and I'm thinking about attachment parenting groups where babies like in upcoming where the babies are carrying around. So my question is this: how do we change the political will of our politicians to realize that we have to have a system, a social system and Medicare system, that will allow people not to live in poverty so that we can so that they can have the toys and things to stimulate themselves, their brain development, the development of their children, and that we can actually change this whole thing instead of enslaving us and blaming the victims of poverty? How do we have a level playing ground?
It's a good question, and if I just thank you for the compliments on the early days, I can tell you that we weren't always well received, as you will remember, too. We had a different vision of the university, and it turned out we won. Everybody won, how's that, in my view. The way we have to do this is by educating the politicals, and so Fraser Mustard was contacted by the government of South Australia, and he spent the last several months there. Fraser is 80 this year, and like Howard, he's a force to be reckoned with. And he's been the thinker in residence for the government. They're changing their entire system based on his recommendations. This is why we're having a meeting in Red Deer. I have nothing to do with organizing the meeting, but I don't do meeting, but I just am happy to participate. But the meeting in Red Deer is designed by Fraser to try and begin to have an effect on our deputy ministers, assistant deputy ministers, and ministers if that's possible. To try and, education is the key here. If you don't know about it, you can't do anything about it.
Hi, I'm Luella Conhead. One quick question, one slightly longer one. What time does the program start tonight and where is it?
It starts at 7, it's at the 8.
Okay. And one of my favorite TV programs is House. And I understand a good bit of the background of it is fairly scientific. I was watching a program last night, and it talked about how a lack of vitamin B12 can cause a person to have feelings of guilt. Is that in fact true from your knowledge? And if it is true, great, tell me more about it. And if it isn't, are there other things like that where a lack of vitamins and so on cause feelings in the brain or feelings that the brain experiences and that we then feel?
Well, I feel like a bit of a charlatan since there's two nutritionists sitting over here. But I can tell you that B vitamins, both B1 and B12, have an impact on brain function. Thiamine, is it thiamine 1 or 12?
One.
Thank you. Thiamine deficiency leads to Korsakoff's disease, which is related to excessive alcohol intake. Pellagra is a disease caused by B12 deficiency, and is it B6? Whatever. B something. Thank you. I told you I felt like a charlatan on the nutrition bit, and that's why it's added to bread, because of the difficulties. You get a lot of paranoia and dysfunction with personality disorders from those deficiencies. So the feelings of guilt, I can't really comment on that except to say that we know that vitamin deficiencies are related certainly to bipolar disorders, and so and probably other disorders as well. So there's no reason to think that there aren't connections.
And can you talk about what happens in the brain to cause that when you're vitamin deficient?
Well, what the brain has to do is it has to make proteins in order to make connections. So when you're making connections and maintaining connections in the brain, so here's a key thing. You make the connections in the brain, but they're not static. And you've got to keep them up to date and keep forming them. And so you keep turning cells over, or connections rather, over and over.